This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
I'm now going to bring in two of the most successful development directors in UK universities. Laurie Manders next to me and Miles Stevenson on the end. They're both going to have a sort of introductory remarks, and then we're going to sort of form a panel discussion afterwards. So, Miles, if you could start us off.
I don't have slides, you just have the voice. When I came down on the train this morning, I was reflecting on how long I've been doing this, and I was having to do it actually with my fingers to do counting, and I've been doing development work for 19 years now, so quite a long time. And I would have never thought when I started it what I would be doing now. So at the end of last year, we had a royal visit by Her Majesty the Queen opening a new facility. It would help to raise £10 million. And last month, I've been in Taiwan, never been to Taiwan before, with my vice-chancellor. And the university we visited took us up to a mountain retreat where they just had mushrooms for everything. Mushrooms to eat, mushroom facials, and then they had this mushroom liqueur. And they were having these things, and they were doing these down-in-one sort of things. And my vice-chancellor just looked at me, and he said to the professor, "This is my development director. He drinks for me." So I had to spend the whole evening drinking, which was great. I've got 15 minutes, so I haven't got very long to do 19 years, so we're not going to do that. We're going to have to skip it. I was going to talk about four things, a little bit about my time at Bristol, a bit of my time at Sheffield, the key building blocks that I think are involved in this sort of work, and also the traps, because you learn more from the mistakes than you do from the successes. I could rant for 15 minutes about successes, but you won't learn much. You want to learn more about the mistakes, and I was going to set you four challenges. So back in 1993, I joined Bristol, and I missed Eric Thomas at the beginning. I was late on the train here, and he apparently said a nice thing about me, which is very nice of Eric. He talked about 40 staff, and our previous speaker just talked about, I wrote it down, 200 people, 200 people at Tufts. Brilliant, fantastic. I have not got 200 people. When I joined at Bristol, there were only six. Now there are 40. So that's back in 93, and I joined to do alumni relations. And a key message, one of the key building blocks, is do not underestimate alumni relations. It's a very powerful thing. So don't be obsessed just by chasing the money. If you don't have a robust and successful alumni relations program, you are going to go nowhere. The Vice-Chancellor of Bristol who appointed me was a guy called Sir John Kingman, and he told me when he left, before Eric took up post, that there were four things that were important to Bristol's success, and they just raised about £80 million in a 10-year period. He said it was a database. Boring database, absolutely vital, having a really good database and investing in your team that's looking after that. Without that, you're blind and will never find anything. You won't know who your people are. The memories of your staff who pass through and your people in the office, and the average period of time, I think, is 18 months. You know, if you're not recording that information, you will never build up anything of a relationship with your donors. And this is all about relationship fundraising. A lot of patience and the confidence to ask. And one of the things that Eric Thomas has been very, very good at is to say, yes, we have a culture of giving in the UK, but we do not have a culture of asking, and especially so at universities. They seem slightly embarrassed to do it. I think the reason I was brought to Bristol to do alumni relations is they've done a lot of trust fundraising. And they've done that for about 3 or 4 years, and they suddenly realize the trusts are a bit bored. They keep on getting applications from us. They'd like somebody else to have a go. And we suddenly realized that if you didn't have an alumni group that were involved, you were missing out on a massive resource of people who could positively help you. So I spent 9 years at Bristol, and I moved to Sheffield. And Sheffield and Bristol are a tale of two universities. They both started doing alumni relations in 1984, and Bristol was a case where they expanded it, and they ended up with 40 staff and a vice-chancellor who's the standard bearer for all this. At Sheffield, they did it for about 7 or 8 years, and then they closed the office down. So when I arrived, they'd been doing nothing for 9 years, and I arrived in 2002. And it had failed. You know, and it wasn't a case that we haven't even tried it. We tried it, and it failed, and failed badly. We raised no money, and no one was really interested. What should we do? And I think the things that have happened in that intervening period across the whole of the UK is other universities persevered, and they realized this was a long-term project, and you weren't in there for a quick buck. And if that was your starting premise, it would go wrong. And now there's at least 20 years of experience to say to people, go in it for the long term. And the thing that I missed, the lovely quote from Eric Thomas, is on legacy fundraising, of all areas of fundraising, there is no legal way of accelerating that gift. You know. And I have monitored 20 people when I left Sheffield, when I left Bristol. I kept in touch with them. Three of them have now died, and those three have given £4.5 million to Bristol. Now, that is a very substantial gift for the university. but it's for that long-term fundraising. And I actually keep in touch with these people because I like them. One of them helped me get my job at Sheffield. So here we move on to Sheffield. I've been told that a university can be a bit like a candy box, and we don't really realise how good our university is. So you've got to be communicating. And in Sheffield's case, there was no communication with their alumni at all, nothing. And we found some old addresses, we sent out some questionnaires, and within the space of 6 weeks, we had 15,000 questionnaires sitting in my office on the floor waiting to be processed. And I looked at them and I thought, that means they want to keep in touch, it means they care, it means they're interested. So we ought to now start cultivating these people. And I thought, well, let's have a telephone campaign. We did one of those at Bristol. We'll do one here. And someone from the office in Sheffield, the one that had been closed down, found out about this, and they said, we hear that you're planning to do a telephone campaign. We would strongly advise you not to do that. And I thought, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And by accident, I came across a file of old donors. And I thought, well, if they've given once, maybe they'll give again. So we did our first mini little campaign, and we spent 7,000 quid. And we called these people using our students, and we raised £100,000. What did my vice-chancellor say? Well done. I will now give you more money. You can expand it. So that was, again, having the confidence to ask. And that was from a starting point of having failed. So if anyone hasn't done a telephone campaign, you've got to start doing that. I'm now going to disagree with one of the previous speakers. I'm going to disagree with Lord Phillips, who spoke this morning. Lovely speaker. I agree with lots of things he said. One of the things he did say was this idea of altruism. If there's anything I've learnt, there is an element of self-interest in a lot of donors. They do like seeing their names on lists. Of our Sheffield donors, it's less than 0.5% who are anonymous. So that idea that you will encounter lots and lots of private, quiet, shy, altruistic, anonymous donors, well, you might find some, but a lot of donors like a little bit of recognition. Another thing we've done at Sheffield, it's one of your challenges, is donor pin badges. I'm wearing a donor pin badge. So was Eric Thomas. Is that a donor pin badge? I spotted that from across the room and I thought, that's a donor pin badge. There are about 15 British universities doing it as a small way of thanking your donors, but it gets it out into the public. It gets it out into events like this. So, of course, when Lord Phillips came across to me, he saw my thing and goes, what's that? And I said, it is a donor pin badge, Chancellor of Essex University. What do you have to do to get one of those? Do you have to give a kidney? And I said, no, you just have to give money. Oh, I don't like that. Oh, it's very public. And I said, but surely that's what you as Chancellor, you should be making this public, that it's good to give to a university. It's a talking point. So I've done a little bit on annual fund. Giving clubs, a few people have mentioned them. They vary from university to university. They are a natural hierarchy of getting people to move from being a single donor to a regular donor to maybe £1,000 to start to move up the thing. We've given out 1,000 of these whilst I've been in Sheffield to people, and it gets it out into the public domain. Major gifts. I'll do you a horror story now because I said I'd do some horror stories. I'd been told about an elderly lady who was interested in making a gift. Her husband had promised Sheffield some money and they'd never followed it up. 8 years had gone by. And eventually I thought, well, I ought to go and see this woman. No, not 8 years whilst I was there, 8 years before I was there. And I wrote to her and I explained why I wanted to come see her. And I said, I know your husband had promised a gift of £50,000 and I'd like to try and reconnect. I know there have been some mistakes. Could I come and see you in Oxford? And the woman, Lady Dainton, because she said I could tell everyone this story, said, yes, you may come and see me. So I travel down to Oxford and I get there and then she opens the door and she's in her late 80s, maybe even 90. So why are you here? And I explained what I put in the letter and she goes, oh no, that's all in the past. No, they had their chance. They blew it. And I thought, it's a bit mean. I wrote about this. I've come all the way here. I told her exactly what it was about. And she said, there's no chance of it. And I thought, well, I'll persevere. And at the end of 2 hours, I decided to grasp the nettle. And I said to her, looking her in the eye, do you think you could ever forgive Sheffield for the upset it has caused you? And she looked at me in silence for 2 minutes, looking at me. And what was she doing? Thinking. And eventually she said, I think I could forgive them. Let's start afresh. And it led to a £100,000 gift. So that's my second challenge. You must get out of the office. Even with circumstances like that that make you sort of cringe with embarrassment about what people have done before. Legacy fundraising. I have done a lot of work at Bristol about that. And I've chatted to several people at their lunch who think, ooh, legacy fundraising is a bit creepy. Oh, sort of funerals, death, all of that sort of stuff. When I started at Sheffield, I inherited a file with 6 letters from people who'd expressed an interest. One of them died this week and is leaving $100,000. But I decided that we, you know, the one thing we could be sure about is there are a lot of people who are spinsters or bachelors or childless couples. At some point in their life, they will have to make a decision about what happens to their estate. And they can leave it to a distant relative, or they can leave it to a cause, any charitable cause. And as Lord Philip said, there are a third of a million charities in the UK. We set up a legacy programme at Sheffield, and we now have 431 people who've confirmed the legacies in their will, and another 1,300 who are interested in it. And since I've been at the university, we've had £3.4 million has come in from 43 people. So it's a very long-term form of fundraising, but the one thing that all of you have got is an organisation that's going to go on into the future. You're not like a business that's going to fold. Stewardship. This is the one of being nice to people, thanking them properly. It's very poorly done by most organisations. And doing stewardship correctly in a highly personal way does take time. But if your thanked donor will become your repeat donor and your bigger donor. And our speaker, the wonderful Rory Brooks, who I like very much, I'd like to take him home, he's great. He understood the importance of being looked after. And whatever you're doing in your system, you've got to have that. And your third challenge I've got getting out, donor pin badges. Oh, here's a horrible one, getting staff giving. I was going to ask Professor Thomas about this. Not just alumni, how about your own staff at the university? Now, I wouldn't do that if you've just started in fundraising. Don't do that as your first thing, because you're going to get a little bit of a reaction. But I've done a lot of work with retired staff who've been really, really good, and we're starting to ease it out. And I've just come back from a visit to Hong Kong, and at City University in Hong Kong, they've got, guess how many staff giving? 80%. 80. I couldn't believe it. People really committed to the place where they work to the point that they're prepared to do a little bit of a salary deduction to help. Some of the things that Shirley Pearce said were super, and you know, it doesn't do any harm from repeating them. Every interaction is important. Look after your old donors. Meet people at peculiar hours. I wrote that down. I had one donor who phoned me, could I come and see you this evening? And I went, yeah, well, it is Christmas Eve. And he came and had tea on Christmas Eve with my children in their pyjamas. You know, I don't know why he wanted to meet on Christmas Eve, but it was kind of important for him. If I was to conclude with something, and I'm conscious of the time, philanthropy is triggered by emotion. A lot of the work I've done is, you know, why do people want to do it? It's a deep-seated thing within their heart that affects them. It's not necessarily a mental decision up here about why they're doing something. That was strongly evidenced by the big gift we've had at Sheffield, which is the largest gift we've ever had since the early university was founded. And it's a £10 million gift for motor neurone disease and Parkinson's disease research. And this was the centre that the Queen opened at the end of last year. This was patient-led fundraising. It started 4 years ago, and it has all the important parts of a campaign. It has three things. It has the academic champion, Professor Pam Shaw, who is very inspirational, very dynamic. I don't know where she gets the energy from, but she's got lots of it. And she spoke to a donor, a patient, who said, what do you want? And she sketched out, and this is the patient who's got the illness, she sketched out what she was trying to do, and the patient said, I'm going to help you. I will start to mobilise people to do it. And they've done it. They've helped to raise this money. It's been a long process. We've worked very closely with them. And my satisfaction seeing it was seeing the faces of the patients meeting the Queen at the opening of this building. They haven't got the cure yet. That's just the start of the process. But this is something that Rory Brooks said, which was, I as a donor, I don't want to leave things to chance. I want to see a process moving forward where something will happen. And I want to see the academics doing that in the new building with the proper equipment, and perhaps there'll be a cure. And perhaps something will come that will benefit all of us. I think that's my 15 minutes. I could go on for hours about it. So get out, implement a donor pin badge or something like that, because it'll make it really, really public. Your badge is lovely. It's got like a phoenix coming up. And you can have lots of fun. I helped to design mine, and one of my High Court judges, she asked for two badges, which I thought was a bit greedy. And I said, well, why on earth do you want to have two badges? And ours are some cross arrows. That's the old symbol of Sheffield. And she said, I'm going to wear them as earrings in court, which I thought was kind of cool. Try and get your staff giving, even at a small basis. There's nothing like saying to donors that your student callers are funding a scholarship. And my team at Sheffield, we fund a scholarship for a local student. That's a really powerful signal to send out. Oh, and get your team to stay. If you don't keep your team there, you've got to get that long-term relationship with donors. You've got to have your staff there for a long period of time. If they move every 18 months, it's going to make your life really difficult. Thank you very much.
Over to you, Laurie.
Well, welcome, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here. This is the first time that I've spoken in this new capacity. And hello to the online viewers, because all my former wonderful colleagues are watching in Aberdeen. I'm going to talk about mainly the Aberdeen experience, because this is only my fourth day in the office at UCL. And when I say we, I'm going to mean Aberdeen, because I'm still trying to break out of that particular habit. I'm going to reflect and, on what made Aberdeen successful and share some of the experiences and a few of the problems that we had. I suppose one of the things is really to set Aberdeen in context. And I was Director of Development and External Affairs there for 12 years. And fundraising in Aberdeen started probably in 1495 when it was established. And it really stopped around when the welfare state was created. And I think that's true for a lot of universities. And that up until that point, universities that existed before the welfare state were relying on philanthropic funds for how they moved forward. And it wasn't until the mid-1990s, at the quincentenary of the university, did they start to think about fundraising again. But it wasn't until they recruited Vice-Chancellor Sir Duncan Rice in the late 1990s, and he launched a £150 million campaign, that things really took off. He was an Aberdeen graduate, but had spent most of his career in North America. And the rumour is that I wasn't there at that time, that when he launched it, he'd agreed with everybody that it was going to be 100 million, but the words 150 million came out of his mouth, and that's where we were. So there was no feasibility study, there was no kind of in-depth analysis, there was just a willingness to take it forward. And to date, the campaign's raised over 200 million, and it'll close next year. And one of the interesting things when you go into a campaign, and that worked for Aberdeen, was that the projects never matched with the timing of raising the money. So we would have stopped the campaign last year when we got over the 150 million, but we were right in the middle of raising funds for a new library that won't be completed until the end of this year. And the campaign at Aberdeen was split into two phases, and there's been medical buildings, research projects, chairs, scholarships, a whole range of projects that have been funded. In 2002, Aberdeen had 1,400 gifts, and by the time I left, we were a year. By the time I left last year, we had over 7,000 gifts, and that's raising around last year was about £20 million. We've got 11% participation by alumni. We had about six gifts in the million, £2 million range in the last 2 years, and all our governing body are donors, and 50% of senior management are donors. I think what we've done over the recent, maybe since 2002, is really move from being a fundraising office to a fundraising university. It's really much more embedded into the whole psyche of the place. It's not seen as something that's sitting with the Vice-Chancellor. And it was in the early days, it was seen as his kind of pet project to one extent. And that made it quite difficult as the years went on. And there wasn't much transparency about what we were counting at the beginning as well. And that's another thing that I would stress, is that you're really clear about what you count. And that's because you're counting the philanthropic health of the institution, not just the fundraising from the development office. And Eric mentioned how they make that distinction, and we do as well at Aberdeen. So you know exactly what we're counting, money that's come in through the university that we've had nothing to do with. We know what we've had to do with, but we join it all together because that's what is the philanthropic health. And we also count gifts in kind and all sorts of other things. But if we'd been counting properly from day one, we'd have finished the campaign 5 years ago, probably. One of the things that I was reflecting on, I wrote down 10 things about Aberdeen. And the first one was that we had a really clear vision. About 7-8 years ago, Aberdeen made a statement they wanted to be in the top 100 of the world universities, helped by John and all these rankings that made us focus. But it was really more just something to hang a kind of vision on. And it helped because it brought donors with them. They could see that this was an institution that was on the move, that it wanted to change. And that was really something that captured their imagination. And we had outstanding leadership, that's the second thing, from our Vice-Chancellor. I mean, he is known as one of the UK, along with Eric, as one of the real leaders and pioneers, and created a structure under him that meant that he could do this. He created a lot of time that he could be more presidential and was spending latterly up to 40% of his time on external and fundraising work. But he had a structure underneath him that sort of ran the university. We didn't always have support from the academic community, and it was patchy to begin with, but that came over time, and all our deans and vice principals are involved. I was thinking of a good example of how that worked, and there's a building called the Sutty Centre, and funded by Ian and Dorothy Sutty. And that was a good example of where it's a joint project with the NHS for a new building for training doctors. We had to have an arrangement with the NHS to agree how we would approach donors and how they would help fund it. And we got Sir Graham Cato, to front it, which helped. And that really worked, and we learnt a lot from that. We'd probably do it a bit differently in some respects. But it was our first kind of joint partnership with the NHS, and I think if you've got a medical school, that's probably something you're going to have to face up to quite soon, of working in partnership. But using that academic champion was a really good model. The fourth point that Duncan would, if he was here, he would say we didn't put enough resource in at the beginning. People felt reluctant. You look at development office, it's costly. The returns are not obvious in the beginning. And his advice would always be to really grasp that and get over that. And even in difficult times, you should really resource it, because if you're not going to resource it properly, then it won't work. It was interesting listening to Rory, because like so many of the donors that I've been involved with, they're passionate about the added value, that transformational side. They're really not interested in funding kind of core activity. And unless you have really big and exciting transformational projects, then it's difficult to get those big sums. So if you've got, go around academics sometimes and they'll say, well, I really want this piece of kit now, or I could do with some money here to fund this right here now next week. It's how you shift your institution into getting those really big ideas that with enough timescales in front of them so that you can actually make it happen. So not the capital project that's, you know, a bit short of money and is going to be finished next week, but what's the capital project in the next 5 years? And I think, you know, having a campaign, and it's not, there's lots of successful fundraising outfits in the UK that are not in campaign, but having a campaign is a useful vehicle for packaging up those projects. The sixth thing is about institutional priorities, and echoing what Gretchen said about how you turn that kind of academic interest, whether it's in Hong Kong in some partnership with Hong Kong University, and Hong Kong's a hub for students and you've got a lot of alumni there, and marrying all that up together. And we did that in Hong Kong in particular, and we did it in six kind of hubs cities in the States where we had the most alumni. Building relationships, though, with all levels of donors. It's easy to talk about, oh, the donor that gave 2 million or the one that gave 1 million, but it's the people that are giving regularly £50 or the people who've given 10,000 or the people committed a legacy. You've really got to try and work at all levels. I suppose the only thing about working at all levels is making sure you've got the right people getting behind the right donors so that your vice chancellor's time is spent on absolutely the top people and really putting a lot of thought and care into how you use them, because they won't be spending 40% of their time like Duncan Rice did, but if you're spending 10%, you want that 10% to be really focused. Rory mentioned that asking for money is a bit like having sex for the first time, and we became quite promiscuous at Aberdeen. And I think that it's difficult the first time you do it, and like any of these things, that's asking for money. But I think that one of the things that we really do is work together with academics. So, because I had one academic who said to me, I'll never ask anyone for money. And I said, well, I don't necessarily need you to do that. That we can work together and work around that. But academics are the ones that are going to be really enthuse and excite the donors. And you're there as a professional support, and that's great. But if you can work together on an ask, then it does make a huge difference. Looking after donors is really, really important. And I think reflecting on the last month in Aberdeen, I spent most of that time handing over donors to people. I spent a lot of time with donors on the phone, donors in California. I've been corresponding with all the people that I had the most relationship with, just to hand them safely over. And like Miles, you kind of feel kind of quite possessive of them, and you want to make sure that they're looked after. And one donor who's just given us £1 million for our new library asked me into the office last Friday for a drink to say that thank you, and they enjoyed working with me and had a little present and had a bottle of champagne, and it was very nice. And it's just something, you know, very personal. And although it is an institutional relationship, and that's why the database and all those things are really key, because at some point people do move on. And it is important that those relationships are maintained. So I've been, you know, desperately writing things down and making sure everything's up to date so that that's all smooth. They maybe won't agree in Aberdeen when they're watching this, but but they've all got my email. And I think the other thing that we benefited from was that we worked really closely, because we're all part of the same team, with alumni relations and with our communications and our public engagement. And sometimes development people want to create lots and lots of events, but there's lots and lots of things happening in our universities anyway, and it's just about thinking and joining things up, and that works really well. And I think my final thing would be invest in your staff. You mentioned that, Miles, and I don't think we've talked much about fundraising staff, but it is difficult to recruit, retain, and you invest in people and give them space, because they do work quite differently from other areas of administration, and so they need a bit of love and care, and they need to be rewarded, and they need to be developed, and they need a reason to stay, because if they're good, then they can move. So that was my reflections on Aberdeen. So you ask me back in a few years, I'll tell you what UCL's like. Thank you.
I'd just like to say that it's international fundraising is not like having sex in different countries or anything like that. Think about that. But there is a lot of body language, and it's different in every country. So it is. There are relationships you need to negotiate and maneuver fairly carefully.
Good. Well, keep that in mind. Right. Well, thank you all, and most recently to Laurie and Aberdeen. If you want to email in taking issue with any of that, we've still got time to get it in. By all means, come in whenever you like on questions from that session. One at the back.
Sorry, I'm always starting. But it's just I was going to ask first one, two, and three again. But we all have targets or things like that. And the take-home message, a lot I take home from this, is that it's a long-term thing. But then you still need to sort of satisfy your vice chancellor that you're meeting your targets. So how does development officers, I like opinion, or what you guys, how do you sort of say that you're doing your job all right, that your vice chancellor doesn't care in the department, and get them to buy in or work with them on this long-term project? Or, for example, like your project of having a set goal, that's you reach that and you're successful. So just your opinion on the long-term problem of we're doing a good job. How do you have outcomes on your job?
I'm happy to go first. You've got to measure a lot of things. When I started, I was very lucky that they were all of the senior management at the university, apart from one, were engineers, and they loved measuring things. And my vice chancellor at the beginning said, of course you can measure money, that's a pretty easy one, but I want you to be measuring a whole range of other things. I want to, you know, how many alumni fill in questionnaires, how much engagement, how many people come back, how many emails are you sending out. And I want to see statistics, and I want to see trends, and I want to see them established over a period, you know, the next 5 years. So I'm not obsessed by money in year one. And again, with legacies, as I've made a slight joke at the beginning, you know, you cannot predict when legacies are going to come. You can do a legacy pipeline based on actuarial ages of death. It's a pretty irrelevant statement to do. I did it on one, and they said, who the hell's he, this guy here? And I said, that's Frank. He's 100. According to the data, he should have died 80 years ago, but he's very well. So having things that you can measure were very important. And one I've used for alumni relations, we did a survey of current students at Sheffield to ask them, when you chose this university, was the endorsement of an alumnus important in choosing it, whether that was a brother, sister, teacher, cousin? And for 30% of the students, it was very, very important. When you translate that across to international students, and obviously fee-paying international students, that has a financial value. And that's one of the important things for alumni relations. You've got to inform your graduates about the university now, because otherwise they're memorizing it from, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
We've developed quite a number of KPIs, financial process and staff-related ones. The staff-related ones are on retention, days training, days sickness, that type of thing. The process ones are the emails, how many people turning up at events, that type of thing. And then obviously the financial ones, the hit rate for applications, and There's two pages. I'm happy if anybody wants to email me. I'm quite happy to share those two pages with anybody about the measurements that we tried to follow. We didn't share them amongst the whole university, but you need, you know, some of them we did. But you need a bit of reality in all of this as well.
I think there are both in internal measurements and external measurements. And externally, if you're thinking about how you kind of rank with a peer group, there's things like the CASE International Benchmarking Study that you could participate in. You could probably just Google CASE International Benchmarking and find that tool to see, you know, what do how your international practices and programs, as well as what the international alumni think and their perceptions of the school, and then how does that rank over across of other, you know, it's basically a tool for you, but then you can see how you compare with other institutions that have participated in that tool. But I also think it's when you're thinking about, you know, your day-to-day, how you're doing what you're doing, and you're doing it well, and your funding's going to continue, success breeds success. And at the, you know, I've built the network for Tufts from 12 to 70 groups worldwide. So it was, there were about 9 domestic and 3 international groups in 2002, and now there's 43 in the States and 27 internationally, and there's more interest. But that scale is about where we need to be right now, but it's more than kind of getting butts in the seats in terms of events. It's about the interest and to know that someone is interested in the school and that they're engaged, even though they can't go to an event, they're interested in staying involved. And so we've been you know, measuring, I think, the level of engagement through growing more shared interest groups, we're looking at affinity through professions and through outside interest, how they were involved when they were students on campus. You know, that emotional tie that they have to the institution, where did that come from? Did that come from a faculty member? Did that come from an experience with a sports team? And now, one of the things that I've launched, because I don't do just international work, I'm also managing a new alumni group called the Tufts Entertainment Arts and Media Network. These are alumni who are in the creative professions of drama, dance, music, communications, literary arts, fine arts, digital, interactive. These are these creative fields that people are in, very self-promoting types of work and fields. And we are now have a new website, it's tuftsteam.org, and I basically have built a community for people to find each other and to collaborate and to feel that they are part of something bigger. And we're measuring that just in the last 2 weeks. We just invited them to join the LinkedIn group for tuftsteam.org, and 400 members joined in the first week. 400 that I could say joined in 1 week of an invitation, and they're, like any LinkedIn discussion, they're going back and forth, and they're talking about what they're doing professionally and finding each other, and it's like another Facebook kind of group, but LinkedIn's very professional, and they're keeping it as such. But social media, we haven't even talked about that, which is a whole other session. And the use of social media in advancement practices, but that's something I think that's easy to measure because it's online and it's tracked. And then I think you're able to, I think, plan and budget for what you need. We'll talk a bit about technology, but the idea of, you know, technology and how that's affecting our day-to-day work, what things will change, what things will stay the same, that's another topic.
I was interested in you're the only person today who's mentioned parents in all of this. I would have thought parents were quite a possible group for not alumni fundraising, but fundraising. Is this something that is not really looked at so much in
the UK? We do fundraising from parents, and one of my first donors at Sheffield was a couple who sent in 2 cheques for £5,000, and I couldn't work out who they were. I knew they weren't alumni. And eventually I started going through the records and discovered that someone with the same name had died 20 years before. And I'd worked out that it was an honour gift in memory of a son who died at university. And since I engaged with this family, they've given £150,000 to Sheffield in memory of their son, and they wanted to do something positive and help provide music scholarships. And just to balance one of Gretchen's things about, you know, high-tech stuff, sometimes old-fashioned letters to people of a certain generation are much more powerful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think I used the term legacy in my presentation. I didn't mean dead. dead people, but I meant the legacies who are the next generation or generation of families that went to that same institution. So some of our parents have students that that are at Tufts. So I mean that's one of the, I think they're some of our most active volunteers are, you know, graduates that went to Tufts and now their daughter or son is a student at Tufts or had been at one point. So
I think the parents is really interesting because I've seen kind of mass approaches to all parents, and that's had limited success. But I know that Bristol are doing a lot at the moment at the admission stage and trying to identify parents there and really being more focused on working, bringing groups of parents to meet the Vice-Chancellor, but really aiming the activity at the ones who have the real potential to do big gifts, because the mass giving is quite... the mass kind of mail shot to all parents is difficult.
We have an opt-in system at Sheffield for parents so that they can start to receive the alumni magazine whilst their children are at the university, because we know that most children won't be telling their parents anything that's going on at the university, and therefore it's nice to keep them informed. And so by opting in, we then do a telephone campaign each year to those parents. And a lot of our parents, their children will be the first member of their family ever to come to university. They're really interested in knowing what's going on. They want to hear about it. And they respond pretty well to a telephone campaign with one of our current students talking about what's going on. But we don't do a mass one to all parents. We get the parents to decide to opt in if they want to receive this sort of information.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be the ones that hadn't been to university themselves would be the most likely. Anyone else want to come in at this stage? Yes, on the right.
Rachel Newbury, Lancaster University. I just had a question about the language that we're using. We've had discussions at our institution about using the terms alumni and development. And Miles, you were mentioning someone asking you about your donor PIN badge and saying, do I have to have donated an organ? what do the panel think about the language we're using? Publicly, would we be better using different terms that may be more accessible and maybe more in line with the language that charities use, where maybe they use supporter instead of donor? That's just a we're having a discussion about alumni and development as a term at our institution.
Sometimes the relationship is richer than just being a single sort of donor, supporter. They're kind of maybe more involved in the institution in all sorts of ways. It's maybe different from a traditional charity where you give your money and you come away. You're maybe also connected in some other way because you are a parent as well as a donor, and you might be in the university council or you might help out informing professional bodies linked to the subject. So I suppose that word advancement really tries to cover everything. Development in this country, some people don't understand it. My mom still doesn't know what I do when I say I'm director of development. She just seems to travel a lot to go out for lunch. But that sort of fundraisers as close as you can get. And I suppose it's one to reflect back to the donors and ask them how they see themselves. But I think they probably see themselves more as supporters.
Mm-hmm. I describe kind of the mission of what we do is we help build regional communities for the university. Mm-hmm. And those regional communities, once built, then they'll have an obligation to commit back to the university, and they'll define that in whatever ways they want. But I sometimes also talk about my work as an agent. It's got kind of a talent agent. I look out for the best of what's happening on the campus. I, you know, kind of export the talent and the leadership, and we meet lots of folks around the world. They are able to, you know, describe what they do in the university, and they ask for involvement, support. But in fact, there are some really, really key alumni and graduates all over the world who are wonderful, wonderful examples of, and products of the university. So I also represent them too, and we try to, you know, work with them as often as we can, and take them on as roadshow and programs and talents. So it's really matching interests and needs, and having a very, very good sense of how people fit and how people network to each other. I think that's one of our biggest jobs, is to make sure people are continuing to meet other graduates and network through professions or, you know, personal experiences. The value, I mean, that they're, you know, this value of this lifelong relationship can grow exponentially, I think, over time. And so to have those types of opportunities to continue to meet people and new alumni.
Yeah, I mean, the word alumni is a peculiar one. I'm pleased to see in student publications it's used a lot more. It's used a lot more in the press. All of our graduating students are given a mug that says alumni and actually has what it means. But I normally, if I'm talking to students, I'll use the word alumni and former students so they'll understand about it. I still do get people who say, oh, alumni, are you in charge of metallurgy or something like that? They get a bit confused. And I have to say, with our beloved Queen, when I met her and the Vice-Chancellor said, this is Miles, he looks after alumni relations. And she went, alumni relations, how very interesting, and moved on. So it could have been like, I don't know, nuclear physics or something like that. But I trying to find another word that's all-encompassing, that does diploma, certificate holders, graduates, people who dropped out, is hard. And I suppose you end up with alumni, friends, former staff, and supporters. You do end up with a long list. But I think people are starting to understand and use the word alumni a lot more.
Right. Anyone else at this point?
I have one quick question for Miles. Does the staff and administration at the university, are they asked to think about the university in their wills and estate plans?
Well, I've done a lot with the senior management. They get an invitation to come and have lunch with me, so they know what that means, because I'm going to ask them to wear one of these and donate. We send a magazine to a whole range of people up at more around the university, so it's not just alumni, it's a broad church, so that could be people in the local community as well. The more the merrier.
But for someone that may have worked 20 or 30 years at the institution,
when they retire, they're automatically added to our list, and we get a lot of former staff wanting to do something in their will.
I suppose the thing that's sort of come up right through today is the sort of balance between keeping in touch with the small donors and the going for the big ones, who are obviously the ones who really matter to the university in a financial sense. I mean, if you add up all the little donations, they don't come to nearly as much as your motor neuron donation, do they? I mean, how do you apportion the time, and does one necessarily, well, they don't necessarily grow into the other, do they?
Well, this is the one that you don't know if they are going to develop into a big donor. That's the problem. My first donor at Sheffield, and I remember it was a sunny day, and she phoned up. She'd heard about my appointment, and she wanted to give me £250. And I was quite excited because it was my first gift. And then I wrote a nice thank you letter. And next year, she sent £250. And next year, she sent £500. And next year, she sent 1,000. And then she said she was going to put 10,000 in her will, at which point I went to see her. And then she increased it to 30,000. And then she's got two of her friends doing it now. One of them's left half an estate. If you'd said to that first gift, what sort of care do I give that person? You've got to have a care process that is individual and is tailored, because they tell everyone about it, they refer. Mm-hmm. Now, I accept that you've got to, and I wrote down one of the Laurie things, points that Laurie mentioned, which is the head of your institution, their time is precious, and it must be channeled to the people who have the capacity to make a big gift. And one of our donors, I was reminded on the train, on the tube, I was seeing one of them, and he was reading Lee Child. Has any of you read Lee Child novels? He's a crime writer. Very successful. He sells a book somewhere in the world every second. What does that tell you about him? You're laughing, you see. It says one is, must be wealthy, but he's also very popular.
I told you he's a Sheffield graduate.
A Sheffield graduate. So my vice-chancellor went to see him, and he said, why have you come to America? And my vice-chancellor said, I've come to meet you. And he was really pleased about that, and it's led to him funding 50 scholarships at the university. But that's a good use of my vice-chancellor's time, because there's a successful person who might be interested, and it's worth getting on a plane and going to see him. And the donor was flattered to say, I came to see you. I wanted to meet you.
Indeed. I mean, presumably there's no sort of hard and fast rule about how you divide between the big donors and the small.
No, but I think one of the things I love doing most is turning a donor into a volunteer and moving them from, giving and kind of silently giving to getting to know them well. And they may be a trustee, they may be on one of our advisory boards, but they have a very interesting background, or they run a very successful company, or the industry has been in the news and they're happy to serve as a keynote or a panelist. And so we have an international distinguished speaker series, and it's very easy to kind of organize someone to speak during their travel to a few different continents throughout the year. We just, they're happy to do it as long as it's arranged and it can be done at a time where they can fit in their real business with this like extra thing, and that's a real boon. And when you have, we didn't get onto the topic, which is again another session, but that's about recognition, and that's just about recognizing your alumni and your parents and friends for their efforts, and thinking of creative ways to engage others through recognition and award programs. And that's it's always really nice to receive an award from your university, and then they might ask, I've actually just asked this in LA. We have an entertainment award that we give out every year, and they asked me, does this mean I need to give you $10,000 to to staff, you know, to build a table for a dinner. And I said, no, this has nothing to do with that. But it might be on their mind that they get an award and they need to donate. That's not the key here. The key is that you're basically you're going to recognize probably some donors and some volunteers that haven't actually donated anything. They just donated much of their time and their efforts. But you put together a recognition program that might be international. It might be industry-based. It might be based on young alumni. It might be based on families that have gone to the institution. So you need to kind of pick your theme. And it also might be a recognition program that is done in conjunction with a major capital campaign.
I think one of the things that 2012 introduction of tuition fees brings is a stronger link between alumni and students. Mm-hmm. If I was a student going to university now, I'll want to have a lot more in the university publicity that says, if you come here, this is what you might go on to do. And therefore, the point that Gretchen's just raised of inviting alumni back to communicate and talk to your students about, I was there once, I know what it's like sitting in the room, is very interesting. And I think the students will expect it, and the alumni will be quite flattered to be invited back to do it. Yeah. And that whole process running through all of the university's work, whether it's magazines, prospectuses, recruitment DVDs, is a very healthy thing to demonstrate to people that it's an ongoing degree that you have from an institution that helps you in your career.
Mm. Indeed. One last question, yes.
Sorry, it might be a thorny question, but I think two of you, I'm not sure if you've all moved institutions. Now, you've had these relationships for a long time with donors and that. Do you poach them and take them across to your new institutions, or what do you do with your donors once you've got these relationships, and what does your institution expect?
Sign the gagging clause when you leave.
Well, it wouldn't work anyway, would it?
It's very difficult, though, because I think, some of the people I'm thinking of that I've spoken to, they're so wedded to Aberdeen. That's who they adore and love. And although some of the relationships are maybe corporately, Shell's one of the obvious ones in Aberdeen, but the chairman of Shell, who's a graduate of Aberdeen, is on the climate change group at UCL, and so you have to use your kind of discretion. I'm just finding out how to do that well, but no, I think most people are wedded to their
institution.
They're
still listening in Aberdeen.
I know.
No, you don't tend to sort of bundle them up and stick them in the boot of your car and kidnap them. Their link is to the university where they've studied. They'll be very curious about how you're getting on in the next place. And I had one of my alumni turned up. I happened to be away on that day. He turned up to make sure I was settling in okay into my new institution, which I thought was very, very sweet. But I haven't had any overlap between the two institutions at all in alumni.
One last one in the centre.
Pat Cassidy from Glasgow Caledonian University. It's just building on the last question. I think it's important that the... all fundraisers and all relationships with universities or the charity that you're with, that you're very, very transparent and very clear about that, because the worst thing you could do to the profession is to be seen to be poaching donors and supporters. It'll might give you a short-term win, but it'll ultimately muddy the water. So I think that's something as professionals we should all be fully committed to.
Thank you. With that, we're going to have to finish the plenary sessions, or we're going to eat into the seminar time.
One last suggestion. With Olympics coming up, think about opportunities to turn that into a stewardship opportunities. And it may be that the world is coming to London next summer, right?
Indeed.
And so you have about 15 months to plan. Is it the party on campus? Is it the opportunity to go to a special event? Is it an opportunity to have... to meet and greet some athletes? I'm not sure, but I know that the world is coming to you, and there may be an opportunity to think about that in terms of everything we've talked about today, and how can that be leveraged?
Yeah, well, a lot of universities are training centers for the Olympics as well. Thank you to all three of our panelists this afternoon and for all our speakers earlier in the day. Don't forget the seminars, which start at 20 past. Thank you very much.